This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
You recently wrote an article for us for Renovatio, and you make an argument about poetry. So maybe you could just give us a little summation of that.
Certainly. I'm very interested in the topic of the issue about what makes a human being a human being. And I wanted to identify language, which I quite naturally rushed to, as that which makes us human. And i.e. we are the animal with language. But then I was remembering encountering this remarkable text at the beginning of Putnam's Art of Poesy. And in it, he clearly sees language as central to humanity, that really constitutes our humanity as such. But he does not focus on the rhetorical aspect as much as on the poetic, right, which I found really interesting. And so I wanted to explore a reading of his text and to just draw from what he says an argument about why it may be that it's poetry that actually makes us human, a particular form of language, which I think he does associate with rhetoric. But he tends and continues to throughout it to emphasize poetry itself. Right. And I decided after following his reasoning that he thinks this is the case because poetry is a particularly concentrated form of ordering language, metrically, stanzaically, figuratively. And I've begun to see that he thinks that that ordering has a way of reordering the human soul of the one who participates in poetry, and then reorders the soul of others as well. And so it becomes a social order. And I was really quite stunned to see that Putnam thinks that poetry more or less makes us human by remaking us through the poetic art itself.
Right. One of the interesting things about human beings is that I don't think there's a culture or a civilization that doesn't have poetry.
That's right.
It's really an argument for a universality of nature, that there is a human nature. And the interesting thing is almost every peoples and cultures, certainly all the ones that we know, have the poetry is very similar. It's about 3 seconds for each line, and it begins hundreds of years before. I mean, we have recorded poetry from China like I think 500 BC, and Homer obviously in the Greek tradition is even earlier. And another aspect that fascinates me personally is that arguably every single civilization, because we have Aboriginal peoples, and then we have city people, people that create civilizations of very complex aggregates of people living together, and that all of those civilizations are prefaced with great poetry. So, for instance, if you look at the Greeks, I think it's arguable that you cannot have Plato or Socrates without Homer, and the number of times that they quote Homer as a source book, and in the Islamic tradition, the very first book is the Quran, but the Quran is preceded in almost immediately. The 100 years before the Quran is the pinnacle of Arabic poetry, and right before the Quran emerges was considered, they had reached their acme of poetic prowess. The famous odes, the 7 odes that hung in the Kaaba, these were the great, they call them Qasida. And then if you look at European civilization, I mean, arguably are in Norton's anthology, because of the Song of Roland, Mm-hmm. Our literature begins with the Song of Roland. And then the English, Shakespeare is, and Marlowe and all these great poets, Ben Jonson, they precede the King James Bible. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just amazing that the King James Bible, which is arguably what created English civilization. I mean, Chaucer before that, and Beowulf even before that. But arguably, the King James Bible does so much for America. Without the King James Bible, we don't have Abraham Lincoln. We don't have so many of the rhetorical greatness that the civilization produced.
Yeah, the point about Homer is extremely interesting because it immediately raises the question of what do we mean by poetry? And on the one hand, we do mean measured speech.
And okay, so we let's are, define the term, right, yeah.
Yeah, we are talking about dactylic hexameter verse. So on the one hand, we recognize that Plato's own understanding of music is itself arising from Homeric poetry that is musical, accompanied or not, since
with the lyre.
Exactly, yeah. Because meter itself is a kind of lyre within the language.
Sure.
But then, of course, Homer is also a mimetic artist, so not just that it's verse, but that it's mimetic or representational of human action. And what I find tremendously compelling about the antagonistic relationship between Homer and especially Plato, and you're absolutely right, Socrates will quote, Socrates the character will quote Homeric verse regularly. But what I find so intriguing is that it's quite clear that Plato, arguably the first writer of philosophical texts, is clearly imitating Homer. And not just topically, but by fashioning works that have been influenced by Homeric fashioning.
Sure.
I mean, one of the things I like to point out to students is
maybe
that
that's why he wanted the poets exiled, so they wouldn't see.
Yeah, no, that's right, that he was stealing from them. But also that he's fashioning a new form of poetry.
Sure.
It seems naive to me not to recognize that when he critiques Homer as a poet in the Republic, he knows that his audience realizes that the Republic itself is a poem. It's narrated by Socrates, who's the dramatized narrator. He says, "I went down to Piraeus the other day," and you realize that if you were to explore Greek literature and ask where have we heard someone tell their own tale before about going down, it becomes quite clear that he realizes that his audience will know that he's imitating Homer's representation of Odysseus telling his own tale at the Phaiakian court. And so I think that Plato actually wants to write a new form of poetry, but the condition of possibility for that is clearly Homer, and it's that quality of making music, of fabricating through this mimetic art of representation worlds, fictional worlds, in which we can participate and observe and be moved by characters who are not people but resemble people, that draws us into a kind of intelligibility of human action and our compassion so often in response to their suffering that I think may actually be central to humanity, which might indicate why it's universal.
Right.
Why indeed storytelling in some form or another is there in every culture we encounter.
And I think a lot of people have pointed this out throughout the ages, that we speak rhythmically, that
we
human
do.
Language is by its very nature rhythmic. A lot of people are completely unaware that Shakespeare is actually in verse.
It's true.
Because it's so natural. To be or not to be, that is the question.
Right.
It flows trippingly off the tongue.
It does indeed.
And
you can scan parts of Lincoln and Melville, too,
absolutely.
By the way.
I mean, you can scan parts of what we're saying.
No doubt.
It's just, especially iambic, because this is the meter of the English language tends to fall into the iambic. But the use of meter in conveying meaning. And before, because I want to extend about poetry, extend it beyond verse, mm-hmm. because certainly the Greek concept, it comes from a word which is basically about artifice, to create something, to make something. Mm-hmm. And certainly imaginative literature is all, if it's good, if it's great, it reaches a level of poetry. But the epic poem, which obviously Homer is our greatest in Western civilization, the epic poem, there's so few people have been able to do it. Mm. And it's been tried many times. the last time we actually had a character in early American history, Joel Barlow. Hmm. Do you?
I don't know.
He's famous for a poem called "Hasty Pudding," which is very often anthologized. Uh-huh. He was part of the Connecticut Wits. He was a friend of George Washington, but he had aspirations to be an epic. He wanted to be America's epic poet. Hmm. And he attempted, but it was a failed attempt. And it's just very interesting, what's called the noble voice. You know, that was one of Stringfellow Barr, I think, wrote a book called The Noble Voice. Van Doren, actually, about the epic poem. Why is the epic poem so difficult to do?
No, that's a wonderful question. At least in literary studies, we tend to assume that the epic poem took up residence, if you will, in the novel, and so that the novel began to do the work
of the epic poem.
The epic poem. But what's interesting about that is that the novel is really quite essentially composed of prose. Its body, if you will, is a prosy body, whereas the epic poem is in verse. And so a lot of people will suggest that that maybe, for example, Wordsworth's Prelude was the last great epic. But we actually, I think, live in an age of a great epic poem, Derek Walcott's Omeros, which is a magnificent treatment of life in the Caribbean, and takes up a number of questions, and does so by means of a central character named Achille, clearly named for Achilles, and is always running a Homeric parallel along his own quite distinct contemporary Caribbean culture. Dante too is quite influential in that poem. But I think it's very difficult to do, of course, in part because readers are not accustomed to reading verse as often as they used to be, and expect their stories to be in prose. Mm. So when people read literature, they tend to presume that means reading novels. Imaginative literature is, I won't say it's reduced to novels, but that really is the form of literature people most gravitate toward, in part because we haven't taught enough people recently
how to read and to write.
Yeah, no, prosody. That's exactly right.
Yeah. One of the things
is an art that has to be taught.
One of the things about, not necessarily. I mean, there are people that do naturally. The Arabs are amazing at that. I know some pretty sophisticated Arabic poets that really don't know the prosody of and it's like Greek. It's not syllabic, so it's not accentual. Mm-hmm. It's related to the actual duration of the word. So it's long, short, as opposed to light, heavy, or heavy, lighter, heavy.
That doesn't surprise me though, actually, because as you were saying, it indicates. Poetry itself indicates some natural talent for it,
right?
Which means that the measure in language is natural to language.
Yeah, exactly.
And some people will have an extraordinarily powerful natural gift with or without training. Mm. But art will improve it.
Right.
So even those without as much talent can have that talent improved through art. You often hear about musicians that we would recognize as clearly quite talented who don't know music. My first thought is always, what if they did?
How would it change?
How would it change? What would be the accomplishment if all four of the Beatles actually knew how to read music.
Yusuf Islam, Cat Stevens, I heard him once say that he found it so difficult to learn other people's music, so he just decided to write his own. and I thought that was really interesting because one of the things about classical musicians is that all they start from day one learning not really how to make music, but how to imitate music. And and this is something the pre-modern world was obsessed with mimesis, with artifice, with actually... One of the things that was very common, the idea of creative writing would have been insane to anybody before the 20th century. The idea that you could teach people how to write, what you could teach them to do was how to imitate.
Yeah, exactly.
And so they would, you know, have a sentence like "when in the course of human events," and then the student would have to write a sentence with completely different words, but following the form of that sentence. And so artifice was not a negative thing, whereas today it's become a very negative thing. And I think one of the tragedies of a lot of modern, especially the young people, I actually think it's really unfair to them to encourage them to write poetry, because 99.9% of it is tripe, and they're not... Because their self-esteem has to be boosted, we're not allowed to actually say that's doggerel and it's complete rubbish. We have to say, well, gee, that's wonderful, great, you know, way to go. And instead of doing the traditional way, which would have, they would have memorized great poetry.
That's right.
And internalize it. I mean, we talk about learning something by heart. And it's such a beautiful idiom, the idea of internalizing something. And one of the things that... the Arabs say that if you want to be a great poet, memorize the corpus of a great poet and then forget it.
That's right.
And I think Dylan, to me, who, you know, there's a lot of debate about Dylan, but I really do think he will be in the canon. That's my personal view.
Indeed.
And there are people like Christopher Ricks. And others. I just read a book about him, Why Dylan Matters, from a Harvard professor, making that argument. And I think Dylan, when he came to New York, I think he knew 200 Woody Guthrie songs.
Of course he did.
and he was basically a Guthrie imitator, using Ramblin' Jack Elliott's style. And then the other major influence on him was Hank Williams, who is also a really, I mean, I think quite an extraordinary lyricist.
Ricks makes a. I've heard Ricks make this case actually in public that that he thinks he's influenced as well by a number of poets, including Eliot. This dynamic.
Well, he read Verlaine, Rimbaud. Rimbaud definitely had a big impact.
This
on
dynamic him. of imitation up to a habit.
Right.
And then a habit which is no longer consciously imitating and then becomes innovative, I think, is actually the classical model for education itself. It's interesting that we're talking about teaching people how to write, but of course we also want to make readers. And so I think because of a fear frequently of the massive technical vocabulary that's often involved
in prosody.
People will be worried, if you will, about introducing young people to poetry. But I think it's a mistake because for one thing, you cannot suppress it.
Right.
So in fact, the desire for rhyme, which is a different kind of accord than
although
meter.
Although most poetry globally is in blank verse.
Yeah.
So rhyme is Chinese poetry is definitely, the Arabs are obsessed with rhyme.
Yeah.
You know, there's a great scene in Dead Poets Society where the character that's played by
Robin Williams
rips out that, you know, that kind of Cartesian analytic approach, the X and the Y bar,
to determine
whether a poem is great. And even though the message of that film I didn't like, but that one scene I really appreciated because I remember very clearly the first time a poem hit me in the gut, like I was in eighth grade, and it was a literature class. I was actually at a progressive school where they had four quads, and so based on your aptitude, you went, like, they had a quad for, it was actually pretty horrific now when I think about it, the social engineering. Yeah. But they had a quad for math and science. They had a quad for arts and music and things. And then they had a quad for just like vocational. These are like eighth graders, seventh and eighth graders.
So the students were divided by
quads. I was in the language arts quad. But I remember clearly reading Ozymandias and it was just, it just really affected me in such a deep way. And that was the first time a poem had ever done that me. And
well, I was just going to say,
I don't think had it been explained to me in that X, Y type thing, it wouldn't, it was a gut reaction.
I think the question isn't whether, but when, pedagogically. I actually do think that we should bring the art to the students. On the other hand,
we
have to do it in a way that actually
doesn't kill the spirit.
That recognition that you had in your heart.
Like rhetoric. I mean, one of the things about rhetoric that when you learn all the tricks, it can almost take the magic
out of it.
But if you, it can also have the opposite effect where you really appreciate the artifice, where you really appreciate what a master is doing, and when they're true masters, there's a reason why. Somebody like Frost will go from an iamb to an anapest. Yeah. He knows what he's doing, because to him, the form was actually sometimes. He said that a great poet for him, the form, surpasses the importance of the content, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think Shakespeare. I mean, you can see Shakespeare is having fun with language. Mm-hmm. You know, you can see his tongue in cheek. You know. A horse, my kingdom for a horse. I mean, you can hear the horse trotting in that, you know, and it's such a wonderful, so to understand what he's doing, you know, with like a kind of spondee type of.
And it's interesting that you said you can hear it, which means that that memorization is not enough. Actually, what we want to do, I think, as well, is that once a student has memorized a poem, we want them to deliver it. We want them to recite it. And it's there, I think, where the vocabulary comes in as a useful way to explain the recitation that they're doing. I think we don't do enough with delivery, unfortunately.
Delivery is very important. And it's almost nixed from the canon.
No, that's right. Yeah, we live in a loud culture. Right. The volume may not have ever been this high in human culture, but the discrimination of sound from sound is more and more lost.
Memoria, the last two canons are really, they've been nixed. And all of it really. Very few people learn the invention, which is so central. I mean, the first and the dominant, you know, definition, but then comparison, and in the topics of invention, comparison is that's the bread and butter of great poetry. The conceit, finding two things that are so dissimilar and yet bringing them together in a way that's the aha moment. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day?
In fact, in the Poetics, Aristotle says, and this I think actually confirms something you were saying before, he says that the power of metaphor can't be taught. And I'm not convinced of that, by the way, but it's a very interesting idea that indeed the ability to see counterintuitive likenesses, which then become quite intuitive, is a real gift. But there's no doubt about it. Figuration is crucial, and metaphor central. But I still think a lot about this need to ask students to stand and to deliver, to use another teacher movie that I enjoy. And that is to ask them to speak. Because what
the office of assertion.
No, that's right. More and more what I find is that students will
That was a plug for your book.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Go ahead. The students more and more actually have trouble articulating themselves.
Right.
And again, it's not because they don't have quite very intelligent and interesting things to say, but they're frequently intimidated by public discourse.
Sure.
There are exceptions, no doubt. It seems to me that any number of young people who are particularly naturally gifted at it.
Yeah.
But I think to ask them to memorize so that they don't have to access their phone, to ask them to memorize and to ask them to recite and to recite artistically, I think is itself a great gift, because at that point they're being given their own voice, but it's a voice that's being educated by poetry itself.
I make students memorize, to their chagrin, in every class that I do. They have to memorize. And I incorporate poetry and all. When I taught astronomy, I had a book on all the poetry to deal with the stars. So, and when I taught ethics, they read The Merchant of Venice. Uh-huh. So I always have poetry and bring it in and incorporate it. I think it's really important. I think one of the things about...
Did you use Sonnet 116 for the astronomy course?
I can't remember. Yeah. I actually had a book that was just poems about the stars. Yeah. But one of the things about poets, I think, is they just have brilliant ears, because people are saying poetic things all the time. Children are saying poetic things. Yeah. I was at the grocery store the other day, and there was this elderly, I think she was probably Filipino American lady, and she was a little plump, and she was in front of me, and her husband or significant other showed up. She was about to buy things, and he showed up with a Ben and Jerry's Cherry Garcia, you know. And she looked at it, and just her eyes lit up, and she said, "Oh, my favorite!" And she said, "But I've gained so many pounds eating that. But happy pounds." And I just thought, man, what a great, you know. And I think that's what Dickens was able to do. He just listened to people's conversations, because one of the things that's so clear from great poets is their characters are so different.
Yeah.
You know, and a bad writer's always, you feel the sameness.
That's right.
In the characters. Whereas great writers are clearly... I once saw somebody, he was reading Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov at the airport. So I just said, "How's that book going for you?" And he just, he put it down, he looked up and he said, "This is not fiction." It's like, exactly.
That's right.
And that's what great poetry is, not fiction in that way. It's like mythology. You know, it's the mythos. My father's definition of mythology was too true to be believable.
Oh, that's right.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think Dylan, you know, there's an old skit from a program where they have Dylan at Woody Guthrie's bedside. Hmm. Do you ever see that?
No.
Where you know, they're actors, and he says, "How's things going, Woody?" And he's like, "The answer's blowing in the wind," and Dylan's writing it down. And he said, "You know," he said, "I'm so sad to see you in this." He said, "Don't think twice. It's all right." He's like writing it down, and you know, it's obviously making fun of. Ginsberg once asked him, "Do you think you'll ever be tried as a thief?"
Huh.
But I think that's what Dylan had, that ear. You know, I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. I can hear somebody saying that in a conversation.
Definitely.
And he's got his notebook out. So I think that's in some ways the gift of the poet, is that they're showing us something about the world that we might not have thought about. It's like Van Gogh, because painting is a type of poetry as well. You know, when Van Gogh paints old shoes, and it forces you to look at those shoes, and you'll never look at a pair of old shoes the same way.
No, that's right.
And I, a friend of mine, we were in West Africa. He's a brilliant photographer, Peter Sanders, and he took a picture of this old ladder that that was literally two sticks with other sticks tied together on a rope, and it was up against an adobe house. And this was, it was a primordial ladder, right? Really just, it must have been, the first ladder must have looked like that. And I actually had seen that ladder several times, but I never really looked at it. And his photograph forced me think about that. And I think, you know, when Emily Dickens says something like, there's a certain slant of light winter afternoons that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes, that slant of light winter afternoons will never be the same for
that's
you.
That's right. And we all know it.
Yeah,
but now we know it in a new way.
In a new way. And that's the the conceit there of death and, you know, the declining day of a winter afternoon.
But I think that's the paradox of poetry, that though it frees itself from the real, it ends up revealing the real. And so what I have more and more come to believe is that Aristotle is right, that poetry is actually more philosophical than history.
Yeah, that,
because it's not
it
bound.
It deals with the universal.
It does. It's not as bound to the actual particulars.
Yeah.
And in that imaginative transformation is a displaced representation that we then can encounter without the difficulty of encountering ourselves directly.
Well, and that's the catharsis. I mean, that was the whole event, whatever was happening at the amphitheater in Greece, the experience. I mean, these were really religious experiences and the revelation that occurs, not just in the play, but in the spectator, the one that's experiencing the play, that internal revelation. The play is the thing wherein we'll catch the conscience of the king, that there's something that's revealed in the play that corresponds to something being potentially being revealed in the self. There's a great Borges story, A Night in Cordova. Have you ever read that story?
Not recently. Yeah. No, I don't remember it.
He's got Averroes, Ibn Rushd, is reading the Poetics, and he's having a really hard time understanding, you know, what Aristotle's talking about, and because the Arab tradition did not have theater, and so he has to go to a dinner, and he's not really happy about it. But he goes to the dinner, and they're having a conversation about whether or not Jahili poetry was still relevant, this pre-Islamic poetry of the 6th century and 7th century Arabia was relevant to Andalusians who were living in a completely different culture. And he quotes, and you know, Borges is always mixing reality with his own imagination, but he quotes a famous poet Zuhair from the Seven Odes, and about that that he saw death like a blind camel, that fate, you know, was like a blind camel. It just stumbles. And did camels really have anything to do with us here in Cordoba? We're not. And so they're debating this. Then the conversation turns to this character who's just come back from Persia. And so they ask him, "Oh, what did you see in Persia?" So he starts talking about how he saw a play. Because the Persians do have a tradition of passion plays. And so they're asking, "Well, what's a play?" And he begins to explain, it's these people get together on a stage and they act out a story. And they're all like, "That's ridiculous. Like who would believe something like that?" And he said, "Well, that's just it. You start believing it."
Yeah.
You know, so
indeed.
The suspension of disbelief. And then a light goes off in Averroes. He realizes what Aristotle was trying to convey, and it's a beautiful story.
Oh, I'm definitely going to have to read it. But that displacement, which then allows us to recognize ourselves in characters and their actions who resemble us but are not us, I think is extraordinarily liberating.
Right.
I've more and more realized how difficult it is for any of us to understand ourselves without some way of doing it in which we don't have to look directly at ourselves.
Right.
And so the therapy of drama, the therapy of both tragedy and comedy, actually, it seems to me, is that we're liberated from ourselves even as we're seeing versions of ourselves in the mimetic world. I think Shakespeare is particularly good at that.
Well, he's one of the greatest, obviously. Yeah.
Indeed, especially with respect to getting his own play going and then establishing a play within a play,
right. From
which characters will learn or not learn about themselves. It's an obsessive technique of his.
Well, and I think
he's
forcing us to see the play within our own play. I think it's a Platonic idea that there's something else going on alongside this.
No, that's right.
This experience. There's a whole spiritual dimension. I mean, Midsummer Night's Dream is a good example of that, where he's got all these dimensions alongside this dimension and the kind of sleepiness. I mean, that play, that's another play that had a huge, I mean, arguably, when I was thinking about converting to Islam, I actually went and saw that play. And in some ways, that was the play that convinced me to actually convert.
You were converted to Islam by Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah, because I'd been in a head-on collision and I really felt like I had, it was a kind of a wake up. I was only 17 and I really, according to the Highway Patrol, I should not have survived the crash, but I did. And it was very strange experience like that I had after that, for several days. I was like, am I here? Is this real?
And, you felt spectral.
Yeah, very, very strange experience. And when I really started studying religion seriously at that point, and I did that for about a year. And I went through, my mother had always told me that she raised us that religion was largely an arbitrary thing, that most people just have the religion they were brainwashed into, and they get entrenched in it, and this is the truth, because I was born in Sri Lanka, and therefore I'm a Buddhist, or I'm a Hindu, or...
It's a mere convention.
Yeah, it's a lot less solid ground than a lot of people would like to think. So I decided just to look at the different religions and what they had to say.
What was it about the play, Midsummer Night's Dream?
It was actually the end when Puck comes out and kind of says, if we shadows have offended, think but this and all is mended. That you've just slumbered here. There's just a dream.
That's right.
And it was, I kind of felt like that car crash was like, it's time to wake up. And I realized I could go back to sleep. And
easily,
and it was, do I set out to wake up and make a conscious go of it with my life, to use my life as a spiritual path of awakening, to actually awaken to our true self, whatever that is, and that's what I felt I didn't have an option, that I couldn't just go back to sleep.
By the way, what's fascinating?
And it was in Santa Barbara, and it was actually the Royal Shakespearean. They were there.
So it was an actual production.
It was a production from England, and they were really great. Yeah.
The interesting thing about that play is that Bottom is the one character who can actually pass from one order to another.
Right.
He actually goes from the human to the spirit world and then back again, and has some form of a relationship with a quasi deity.
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated by that because he is the player.
Well,
he's the one who wants to
play
all the parts.
Well, says I can play all the parts.
No, indeed. And so he's the most theatrical.
Right. Yeah.
And yet, it might not be an accidental relationship between his theatricality and his spiritual distinctness that he actually can pass back and forth. And when he does pass back, when he's de-metamorphosized, right, from ass to man again, he actually comes back revising St. Paul. He comes back with indeed a vision. And although he's not allowed to share that that vision by Theseus, once they do the play within a play in Act 5, he's also the one who can boss Theseus around at certain moments. Yeah. He actually speaks back to him.
Sure.
And I've more and more begun to think that he's the unacknowledged king, if you will, of that play. And although at first it startled me to hear you say that Midsummer Night's Dream played an important role
In
your conversion, I actually think that play is seriously exploring exactly what it is that makes it possible for us to experience this order as not the only order.
I totally agree. Yeah.
And to pass, if you will, back and forth.
Well, also, you know, my dad, who I don't know anybody that would even come close to his knowledge of Shakespeare, he was convinced that Bottom was Shakespeare, like that was his, that it, you know, I shall call it Bottom's dream, for it hath no bottom, that Shakespeare was able to dream impossible dreams and continue to dream throughout his life, and that the imagination
he certainly identifies with him. The play adores him. I've never seen a production, even bad productions, during which the mechanicals didn't bring down the house, and Bottom in particular.
Yeah.
But to take him seriously as a seer, or maybe even some kind of prophet, makes us realize that the stakes of poetry may be much higher than we realize, that these mere fictions are actually a form of spiritual training.
Well, the muses.
To catch the impermanence, the theatrical quality actually of actual life.
Well, the Arabs believed that the poet was possessed by a genie, you know, that there's actually a great, they have a group of Arab poets, they're called the outlaw poets, and they really are, they're amazing characters. One of them was called Ta'abbata Sharra, which means he had evil under his arm, you know, like the genies, he's carrying them around. But the outlaw poets were like the Dalits, you know, they were Mambudin, they were people that were expelled or had rejected the tribal alliances, and they became a tribe for people without tribes. And some of their poets are really, really powerful, but they definitely saw a relationship between, you know, the spiritual realm and poetry, that a true poet was somebody who was inspired, that there was something, and undeniably the importance of poetry is accentuated by the fact that there is an entire chapter in the Quran called the poets, and it's recognized that all of the chapter headings of the Quran are momentous things. It's only momentous things get a chapter, like the Jews are, there's a chapter called Bani Israel, you know, because they're a momentous people. There's a chapter called the spider, right, the ant, and even the Arabs ask, like, why is chapters named after these little creatures? And it's like, because these are very, very profound little creatures that have great import, and it's calling attention to those things. And the verse about the poets in the Quran, because they accuse the Prophet Muhammad of being a poet. And one of the things that Amir Abdul Qadir al-Jaza'iri, one of the great scholars and a poet himself, and he fought the French in Algeria and was actually honored in this country. There's a city in Iowa named after him, El Kader, Iowa, because he saved Christians that were being persecuted in Syria. But he wrote a small book called Tanbih al-Ghafil, which in it he argues that the reason prophets are accused of being poets is because of the similarity between prophecy and poetry. The poet, the Arabs have a beautiful expression for what a great poet does. They call it as-sahal al-mumtani', which means the easy impossible. Because it looks like I can do that, yeah. But then when you try to do it, you fall short. And there's something about great poets. And I think, unfortunately for us, lyric poetry, our poetry has been reduced to lyric poetry, mm-hmm. and most because of free verse and the loss of prosody. Mm. Or, you know, somebody like Mary Oliver is clearly capable of writing in verse if she wanted to, and she certainly knows the art, but chooses to write in this free verse. And
I find free verse extremely interesting.
It's actually undeniably interesting, but I think it's a third category. I think prose poetry and to call it verse for me is problematic. The Arabs had a third category, yeah. which is very similar to free verse, which they called, they had nadham and nathar and seja. So they had prose poetry, and then they had a third category, which is more like rap today. It's kind of has internal rhymes, a lot of assonance, a lot of alliteration, but it's not metered and it's not rhymed in any formalized way.
I have a colleague who does some very interesting work on Whitman, a poem I love, and sure. she argues, and I think it's quite astute, that we can think of poetry as meter, or we can think of poetry as line. Mm-hmm. So her argument is that free verse avails itself of any number of formal properties of poetry, yeah. but that what's significant is the line itself.
Sure.
And Whitman, I think, is really quite remarkable for achieving his measure. Mm. In line, as opposed to meter,
yeah,
and that it has a rhythm, and in that sense it's like prose that has a rhythm, but because of the lineation, it's different. So I actually think it may be that free verse is the third category
I would argue that see Whitman, who really starts the ball rolling. Whitman, his is free verse. Mm-hmm. It's clearly versified, mm-hmm. but it's free. Mm-hmm. Whereas a lot of what is called free verse today, mm-hmm. that you can't, if you look at, you know, Captain, Oh Captain, that's mm-hmm. clearly got strong meter mm-hmm. in it. It's mm-hmm. just not fixed to any, you can't say, oh, this is pentameter or mm-hmm. tetrameter or mm-hmm. dimeter, what you can't fix it. It's mm-hmm. but it's clearly metered. He's got rhyme going. He's got it's, and that's why I think what happens later, when you have people like Ezra Pound, because Pound is like Picasso. Picasso could do the realist if he wanted. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a trained painter, but he chose to do the abstract, and it made sense because photography had really replaced realist art. Mm-hmm. But he could do that, mm-hmm. and Pound could write in meter. What a lot of people today are doing, they don't know how to write in meter in traditional forms, and so they're just doing. It's like modern dancing, where you just get out and do whatever you want. Whereas all traditional dancing, you had to learn how to dance. Mm-hmm. The waltz is a very specific set, or the cha-cha, or even, you know, ballroom dancing, all those forms have, and this is, I think this is the demarcation of the modern and the pre-modern world, mm-hmm. is that it's, there's a type of do what thou wilt. It's the Abbey of Thelema, mm-hmm. you know, the rejection of law and order, and I'm going to be free. And nobody's going to put constraints on me. Mm-hmm. And I think the problem with that, and this is why it's very interesting that the great disciplines of our civilization are called the liberal arts. Mm-hmm. They're the arts that free you. Because if I get on a piano and just start pounding away, that's not music. I mean, maybe George Antheil thought it was, but it's not music, you know. But if I discipline myself to master this thing, then I'm free to do whatever I want. And that's where I would, personally, I really feel that to encourage people to do these things without learning the rules, then you're free to break the rules. It's like if I know grammar mm-hmm. and I choose, like Dickens, to have a sentence with one word in it, you know, I don't, the English teacher can say that's not a sentence because there's no subject and there's no predicate. Yeah. But Dickens knows what a sentence is, right? That's and if he chooses to make a sentence out of one word, he has every right to do that. He can break the rules because he knows the rules. And I think that's where I think free verse has destroyed poetry, personally.
Yeah, I don't agree.
That's good. No, but, I wouldn't expect you to agree with me on that.
No, it but, just startled me when you came back to the to that point, because I don't think that it's fully free. I think, again, I think the line is still a discipline. And what it's freed from is,
I think if they know what they're doing,
is metrics.
Yeah.
No, that's right.
But most don't. That's
but I
my
think
point.
That's always the case, in the sense that only those who have mastered an art can transcend it. And in that sense, I am a traditionalist educationally, without a doubt. But when you look, and I'm identifying Whitman in particular because. He ends up being proof of something you said earlier when you were talking about the influence of the English Bible, especially the King James Version, on English and American literary culture, which is really hard to overestimate. I mean, he was a great reader of the Bible, including the Psalms, and it's quite clear that he picks up a lot of his phrasing and clausing from the English Psalms in the King James Version of the Bible. And so in many ways, I think Whitman is actually a traditionalist, that he studied the great books, if you will. But that's always the case, it seems to me, that the untrained tend to make for less compelling revolutionaries than the trained. They're the ones who are actually free enough not only to choose when to obey rules or not, but to invent new rules.
My father wrote a book on prosody. And
really?
One of his lines in there was that he felt Robert Frost scored an ace when he said that free verse was like playing tennis without a net.
So. I'm just saying there were still lines.
I agree. And that's what, my point about Whitman, I do. And if you take a poem like Kensington Gardens by Ezra Pound, I mean, that's as good as poetry gets as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
It's a poem of free verse. It's an incredibly powerful poem. But again, Pound knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
And my argument is that people are it's a default setting. When you don't know how to do something, and you go to the default setting of just doing whatever you can. And that's where I think you lose. Artifice is very important. Art is from ours, you know, power. The word for army is a cognate of art. Art is power. And power comes about from discipline. It's accrued by discipline.
Exactly.
A civilization that's undisciplined will never become a powerful civilization. And a writer who's undisciplined will never become a powerful writer. And that's why I think great poetry is always there. There's definitely the discipline is there. You can feel it. And somebody like, if you take somebody like Cormac McCarthy is a good example of that, who just from one point of view can drive you crazy with his punctuation, but he knows exactly what he's doing and he has a purpose behind that. I'd like to ask him, if I ever met him, what
about particular moments?
Yeah. Well, like what he's trying to convey in that usage. But I really feel like our civilization has lost so much by the abandonment of rules. And one of the interesting things, and Nietzsche brings out this this idea of the Apollonian and the Dionysian, these two impulses. We've become such a Dionysian culture that we've lost the importance of the Apollonian, that that there's a balance between the two, and wonderfully portrayed in Sense and Sensibility with these two, Eleanor and Marianne. I mean, Austin does an incredible job at showing us these two ways of being in the world, and how they're both in essence flawed. That, you know, the end where there's a recognition of the other's worth and the beauty of the other,
that they need one another.
They need one another. And I think we have an interesting tradition in Islam, in Sufism, tasawwuf, which is that the Sufi should be outwardly sober but inwardly drunk or ecstatic. And I think that is that incredible balance of the Apollonian decorum, the idea that decorum is important. I mean, one of the things that troubles me about modern culture is the complete loss of decorum, the importance of, and Richard Weaver, I'm sure you're familiar with that, the ideas have consequences. I think he was really getting at the heart of the crises that we're suffering from in the loss of a sense of hierarchy, that that all of life has hierarchy, and to reduce and level. And I think that's one of the things about free verse to me. It levels. It makes everybody a poet because everybody can do it. And then you lose something in the discipline that that elevates one over the other, not in terms of a kind of inherent superiority, but in an acquired superiority. The Confucian idea of the superior man was a man who had cultivated his character and his being. And that's, I think we've really lost that in our culture. And I think that that loss of meaningful life, a life of discipline, that actually accomplishments are something that are relished because they were so hard earned. When everything becomes easy, when all information, I mean, I can just look up the meaning of any poem on the internet. I can find out what meter it's in and what verse it's in. And I admittingly have done that before.
We all have.
Exactly. But that something is lost. When everything becomes easy.
I share your father's admiration for Shakespeare, and the way that I would approach what you're talking about, which I think is right, I mean, the loss of a sense of decorum is a shame. Unfortunately, we think of decorum as mere manners. We don't think of it as an ordering principle of some kind. But it's interesting that one of the reasons that decorum got a legitimately bad name is that it too often was used to support social hierarchies.
Right.
But what's missed, I think, in decorum, especially with respect to how to train poets, how to teach poets how to write poetry, how to teach people how to read it, is that the submission to a superior artist is how a lesser artist becomes a greater artist. And in fact, in Shakespeare's own example, it's very easy to see that early in his career, he was heavily influenced by Christopher Marlowe. And he took Marlowe as an object of imitation. It's quite clear. Marlowe, in great part because he died young, tends to have a verse less mature than the most mature of Shakespearean verse.
But had he lived, we don't know where he would have ended up.
That's right. And Shakespeare's own imitation of Marlowe made it possible for him to begin to do things that Marlowe did quite less frequently. So, for example, Shakespearean meter tends to be much more regular in the early part of his career, and then he starts to experiment with more and more interesting metrical substitutions, for example. The line changes so that frequently he has end-stop lines at the beginning and relies much more heavily on rhyme itself. We think of him always writing blank verse when, in fact, there's a great deal of rhyme.
He's got a lot of rhyme.
In the earlier work. Romeo and Juliet, for example, often has very interesting end rhymes early in the play. And so then you get this experiment with enjambment that actually comes to define the Shakespearean line, which is really quite distinct. And so what I think we've lost in the very loss of decorum that you're talking about is not the loss of submitting to illegitimate social authority, because let it go, but the submission to legitimate artistic authority, in which your training requires you to recognize someone's artistic talent is so superior to your own that you need to pay attention to learn how to do that. And again, intuitively, we all know this. Aristotle says in the Poetics that the human being is the most mimetic of animals.
Right.
And he says something very interesting that I've actually meditated
upon.
When we know
mirror neurons, we begin to actually mirror the person we're sitting with. Entrainment, the hearts begin to beat in sync with the people we're standing next to.
No, exactly.
Women who live in together, their periods synchronize.
That's right. So that when young people are actually trying to learn something, of course, they imitate their heroes. They play their guitar like their favorite hero does. Right. They hold the bat that way. Yeah. You can always see a young person when they're imitating.
Dylan was imitating James Dean, Charlie Chaplin.
That's exactly right.
Right.
But that is itself.
But then he became who he was.
Yeah, it wasn't just that he became that, but he became it by, in a sense, mastering his master.
Sure. I once saw documentary on one of my favorite lyricists, Hank Williams. Mm-hmm. And Hank Williams could imitate these two singers. Mm-hmm. And he said he realized that he had to find his own voice. Mm-hmm. He said, so I got right in between them. And then in the documentary, they showed the two singers and they blended their voice, and it was Hank Williams.
Huh.
It's just amazing.
Remarkable.
So again, mimesis. Like Toynbee goes in great detail about the mimetic importance of mimesis in a civilization.
But that I think is the paradox of originality and of finding one's
own voice.
There's
nothing original, yeah.
No, that's right. Until one masters another artist one is imitating and then feels compelled to innovate. And at that point, I think newness is born. The truth of the matter is, before Shakespeare, the Shakespearean line of extraordinary metrical volatility and of varied pacing
because of enjambment. It's incredible.
It's new.
Yeah.
It's new. The language.
He did things.
The language
was. He invented words. He was constantly inventing words.
It was a new language. And then we think about somebody like Milton, who's paying a great deal of attention then to Shakespeare, much less so to Marlowe. Yeah. And he himself realizes that metrically volatile, enjambed line is something that he himself can do
in Paradise Lost,
in his epic poem. But he there finds that the Shakespearean syntax is not complicated enough for the reflections and the actions that he wants to represent.
Right.
And his own Latinate training at the university drives him to then create a Miltonic style that's distinctly his own.
Yeah.
But I agree, the liberal arts tradition is a tradition that's ultimately liberating. But proximately...
Through discipline.
That's right. Yeah. But proximately, it requires discipline and submission.
Right.
And the submission to a discipline, I think, is something that's a great gift to young people, whether it's the discipline of music,
that's my point.
Athletics, poetry, because that kind of mastery empowers them much more fully than, how shall I put it, less disciplined forms of expression.
You know, Frost said that the life is a series of disciplines, and the first one is the acquisition of language, of words, and even the nuances of words and the meanings of words. And poets, great poets, they know their words so well, and they reveal that. And you know, Shakespeare, Sister Mary and Joseph, I think, compellingly shows the indebtedness of Shakespeare to artifice, to mastering the books of rhetoric of his time. And Marshall McLuhan, in his book on the Trivium, The Elizabethan age, which created the greatest English literature that we have, was an age of rhetoric. That's what they were doing. And that's why I really feel, you know, just to close this out, I think what you did with the Office of Assertion, because I'd been looking for a book for freshmen, because there's a couple of things about our college students today. They don't know English grammar because they didn't go to grammar school, which to me is a crime against a young person. And two, they really struggle with writing, partly because they don't know grammar, but more importantly because they don't know topics of invention. They don't know how ideas are generated. And the discipline of rhetoric and what you did with that very short but incredibly rich little book was... to really give a student in a very short and concise way the essence of writing a good essay. And I think the essay in the end about Telemachus and from the Odyssey is proof in the pudding. So,
well, I appreciate that a great deal.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, that's how we ended up connecting, and you've now written for the journal. And hopefully it'll continue the dialogue. So I want to really thank you just for coming out. We're here at the upper campus at Zaytuna College, and I also for inviting me out to the University of Dallas. I really enjoyed it. Your hospitality was wonderful, and meeting all those people. And hopefully we'll do that again here, something similar to that. So
we hope so, and yeah. I wanted to thank you and the community at Zaytuna for having me today. It was a delight.
Yeah, great. All right. Mm-hmm.